on, and we walk through the crowd. I am escorted by my new husband, my fingertips resting on his sleeve. There is a roar of approbation, and everywhere I look, I see smiling, avid faces. We sit at the top table, facing the room. There is a ball of trumpets from the gallery, and the first of dozens of plates of food is marched into the room at shoulder height. The servers come to us at the high table first, and put a little from every dish on each golden plate. Then the Duke points from here and there down the hall, so that his favourites may share our dishes. For everyone else, the great bowls of meat come in, and the great platters of white bread. It is a huge feast. My Uncle Louis has spared no expense to please his patron, and to celebrate my rise to the royalty of England. They bring in wine in great golden jugs, and they pour glass after glass at the high table. The honoured guests, those who sit above the great golden bowl of salt, have as much wine as they can drink, as fast as they can drink it. In the hall the men have tankard after tankard of ale, the best ale, wedding ale, specially brewed for today, specially sweetened and spicy. There is a challenger, who rides his horse right into the hall, and throws down his gauntlet in my name. His horse curves its heavy, muscled neck, and eyes the tables in the great circular fireplace in the centre of the hall. I have to get up from my place, and come round on the raised dais of the high table, to give him a golden cup, and then he goes all round the hall at a powerful trot, his rider sitting heavily in the embossed saddle, before cantering out of the double doors. It seems quite ridiculous to me, to ride a horse into dinner, especially such a heavy horse and such a weighty knight. I look up, and I meet the gaze of the young squire, who is dangerously near to laughter, as I am. Quickly, we both look away from each other's dancing eyes, before I betray myself and giggle. There are 20 courses of meats, and then 10 of fish. Then everything is taken away, and Rhenish wine is served with a voider course of potted fruit, sugared plums, and sweetmeats. When everyone has tasted all of these, they bring in the final course of marchpane, pastries, sugared fruits, and gingerbread decorated with real gold leaf. In comes the fool, who juggles and cracks bawdy jokes about youth and age, male and female, and the heat of the wedding bed, which is the fire to forge a new life. He is followed by dancers and players, who perform a masque, celebrating the power of England and the beauty of Luxembourg, with a beautiful woman, almost naked but for her long green tail of silk, who symbolizes Melusina. The best of them all is a costumed lion, the emblem of both our countries, who cavorts and dances with strength and grace, and finally comes, panting a little, to the high table and bows his great head to me. His mane is a mass of golden curls smelling of sacking, his face a mask of painted paper, with a smiling, honest look. I have a gold chain to put around his neck, and as I stretch towards him, and he bows his head to me, I recognize the gleam of blue eyes through the mask, and know that my hands are on the shoulders of the handsome squire, and that I am standing close enough to embrace him as I put my chain around his neck. My mother nods to me that we can leave, and the women and the musicians all rise up and dance in a line round the length of the hall, and then make an archway with their hands held high, and I walk through it, with all the girls wishing me luck and the women calling blessings down on me. I'm preceded by my dancing little sisters who scatter rose petals and little golden keys on the floor where I walk. Everyone escorts me up the great flight of stairs to the best chambers, and they all seem disposed to crowd into the bedroom with me. But my father stops them at the door, and I go in with just my mother and the ladies of her court. First they unpin my high headdress, and lift it carefully away. And then they unpin my hair. My scalp aches as the tightly plaited hair tumbles down, and I rub my face. They untie the laces of my gown at my shoulders to take off the sleeves. Then they untie the fastenings at the back and drop it to the floor, and I carefully step out of it. They take it away to shake it and powder it, and store it carefully for the next important event, when I will wear it as the Duchess of Bedford, and the red lions on the hem will symbolize the house that once was mine. They untie the laces of my undergown and strip me naked. Then, while I shiver, they throw my nightgown over my head and put a wrap around my shoulders. They seat me on a stool and bring a bowl of hot-scented water, and I soak my cold feet and lean back as one of them brushes my hair while the others pull at the embroidered hem of the gown, tidy the fall of the wrap, and put the room to rights. Finally, they pat my feet dry, plait my hair, tie a nightcap on my head, and then they throw open the door. My Uncle Louis comes in, dressed in his bishop's cope and mitre, swinging a censer, and he proceeds all round the room, blessing every corner and wishing me happiness, wealth, and above all fertility in this great match between England and the County of Luxembourg. Amen, I say. Amen. But it seems that he will never stop. And then, from the hall below, comes a great rumble of male voices and laughter and the blare of trumpets and the banging of drums, and they are bringing my bridegroom, the old Duke, to my room. They carry him shoulder high, shouting, "Hurrah! Hurrah!" And they set him on his feet just outside my door, so that he can walk in, and they can all tumble in behind him. Hundreds are left in the rooms outside, craning to see, and shouting for others to move up. The fool capers in, his bladder in his hand, poking at the bed and declaring that it need be soft, for the Duke will make a heavy landing. There is a roar of laughter at this, which spreads out of the room to the chambers beyond, and even down to the hall as the jest is repeated. Then the fool commands the girls to build up the fire to keep the bed warm, and top up the wedding ale, for the Duke may get a thirst on, and then he may need to get up in the night. "Up in the night," he says again, and everyone laughs. The trumpet blasts a summons, deafening in the bedroom, and my father says, "Well, we will leave them. God bless, and good night." My mother kisses me on the forehead, and all her ladies and half of the guests kiss me too. Then my mother leads me to the bed and helps me climb into it. I sit there, propped on pillows like a hand-carved poppet. On the other side, the Duke is throwing off his dressing gown, and his squire pulls back the sheets and helps his lord into bed. The squire keeps his eyes down and doesn't look at me, and I am still, like a stiff little doll, one hand holding the neck of my nightgown tightly under my chin. We sit bolt upright, side by side, while everyone laughs and cheers and wishes us well. And then my father and my uncle guide and half-push the revellers from the room. They close the door on us, and we can still hear them, singing their way down the stairs back to the hall, and shouting for more drink to toast the health of the happy couple, and wet the head of the baby who will be made, God willing, this very night. "Are you well, Chaketa?" the Duke asks me, as the room grows slowly quiet and the candles burn more steadily now that the doors are closed.
"I am well, my lord," I say.
My heart is beating so loudly that I think he must hear it. More than anything else, I am painfully aware that I have no idea what I should do or what he may ask of me.
"You can go to sleep," he says heavily, "for I am dead drunk. I hope you will be happy, Chaketa. I will be a kind husband to you. But go to sleep now, for I am drunk as a bishop.
He heaves the bedclothes over his own shoulders and rolls over on his side, as if there was nothing more to say or do. And within moments he is snoring so loudly that I fear they will hear him in the hall below. I lie still, almost afraid to move. And then, as his breathing deepens and slows, and the snores settle to a steady low roar and grunt, I slip from the bed, take a sip of the wedding ale, since after all it is my wedding day, blow out the candles, and then climb back between the warm sheets, besides the unfamiliar bulk of a sleeping man. I think I will never sleep. I can hear the singing from the hall below, and then the noise as people spill out into the courtyard outside and shout for torches, and servants to show them to their beds for the night. The steady rumble of my husband's snore is like the roar from a bear pit, pointlessly loud and threatening. I think I will never ever sleep with such a great man in my bed. And amid this buzz of thoughts in my head, and my grumbles to myself about this discomfort, and how unfair it is to me, I slide into sleep. I wake to find my new husband already awake, pulling on his breeches, his white linen shirt open to his broad waist, his fleshy, hairy chest and big belly half exposed. I sit up in bed and gather my nightgown around me. My lord.
Good morning, wife, he says with a smile. Did you sleep well?
Yes, I say. I think you did.
Did I snore? He asks cheerfully.
A little.
More than a little, I wager. Was it like a thunderstorm?
Well, yes.
He grins. You will get used to it. Anne used to say that it was like living by the sea. You get used to the noise. It is when there's silence that it wakes you.
I blink at the opinions of my predecessor. He comes around to my side of the bed and sits heavily on my feet.
Ah, excuse me.
I move out of his way, and he sits again.
Jacquetta, I am a good deal older than you. I must tell you, I will not be able to give you a son, nor any child at all. I'm sorry for that.
I take a little breath, and wait to see what terrible thing he will say next. I had thought he had married me to get an heir. Why else would a man want a young bride? He answers this at once, before it is even spoken.
Nor shall I take your virginity, he says quietly. For one thing, I am unmanned, and so I cannot readily do it. For another, I don't want to do it with you.
My hand tightens on the nightgown at my throat. My mother will be appalled when she finds out about this. I'm going to be in so much trouble with my father. My lord, I'm very sorry. You don't like me?
He laughs shortly. What man could not? You are the most exquisite girl in France. I chose you for your beauty and for your youth, but for something else too. I have a better task for you than being my bedmate. I could command any girl in France, but you, I trust, are fit to do something more. Do you not know?
Dumbly, I shake my head.
The demoiselle said you had a gift, he said quietly.
My great-aunt?
Yes. She told your uncle that you had the gift of your family. She said you have the sight. And he told me.
I am silent for a moment. I don't know.
She said she thought you might have. She said she'd spoken with you. Your uncle tells me that you studied with her, that she left you her books, her bracelet with charms for foreseeing, that you can hear singing,
He told you that?
Yes. And I assume that she left her things to you because she thought you would be able to make use of them.
My lord...
This is not a trap, Jaquetta. I am not tricking you into a confession.
You tricked Joan, I think to myself.
I am working for my king and for my country. We are near to finding, please God, the elixir that brings a cure for death and makes the Philosopher's Stone.
The Philosopher's Stone?
Jaquetta, I think we are very close to finding the way to turn iron into gold. We are very close. And then I wait. Then I will have enough coin to pay my troops to fight for every town in France. Then the rule of England can spread peace all over our lands. Then my nephew can sit firmly on his throne, and the poor people of England can work for their living without being taxed into poverty. It would be a new world, Jaquetta. We would command it. We would pay for everything with gold that we could make in London. We would not have to dig it in Cornwall, nor pan for it in Wales. We would have a country richer than any dream. And I am, I think, perhaps only a few months from finding it.
And what about me?
He nods, as if I return him to the reality of this wedding day morning, which is not a real wedding at all. Oh, yes, you. My alchemists, my astrologers, tell me that I need someone with your gifts. Someone who can scry, who can look into a mirror or into water and see the truth, the future. They need an assistant with clean hands and a pure heart. It has to be a woman, a young woman who has never taken a life, never stolen, never known lust. When I first met you, they had just told me that they could go no further without a young woman, a virgin, who could see the future. In short, I needed a girl who could capture a unicorn.
My lord, Duke.
You said that, do you remember? In the hall of the castle at Rouen, you said you were a girl so pure that you could capture a unicorn. I nod. I did say it. I understand that you are shy. You will be anxious to tell me you cannot do these things. I understand your reserve, but tell me only this. Have you taken a life?
No, of course not.
Have you stolen? Even a little fairing? Even a coin from another's pocket?
No.
Have you lusted for a man?
No,
I say emphatically. Have you ever foretold the future, in any way at all?
I hesitate. I think of Joan, and of the card of Le Pendu, and the wheel of fortune that bore her down so low. I think of the singing around the turrets on the night that the demoiselle died. I think so. I cannot be sure. Sometimes things come to me. It's not that I call them.
Could you capture a unicorn?
I give a little nervous laugh. My lord, it is just a saying. It is just a tapestry picture. I wouldn't know what one is supposed to do.
They say that the only way to capture a unicorn is for a virgin to go alone into the forest, that no man can set a hand on it, but that it will come to a virgin and lay its beautiful head in her lap.
I shake my head. I know this is what they say, but I don't know anything about unicorns. My lord, I don't even know if they are real.
At any rate, as a virgin, you are of great value to me. a very precious thing to me. As a virginal daughter of the House of Melusina, as an heiress of her gifts, you are beyond precious. As a young wife, you would be a pleasure to me, but nothing more. I have married you to do far, far more than merely lie on your back and please me. Do you understand now?
Not really.
Never mind. What I want is a young woman pure in heart, a virgin, who will do my bidding, who is mine as much as if I had bought a slave from the Turkish galleys. And this is what I have in you. You will learn what I want from you later. You will do what I want. But you won't be hurt or frightened. You have my word. He gets to his feet and takes his dagger from the sheath at his belt. Now we have to stain the sheets, he says. And if anyone asks you, your mother or your father, you tell them that I got on top of you, that it hurt a little, and that you hope we have made a child. Say nothing about the life we are to have. Let them think that you are an ordinary wife, and that I have deflowered you. He takes his dagger, and without another word, he makes a quick slice against his left wrist, and the blood wells up quickly from the scratch. He lets it come, and then he pulls back the covers of the bed, ignoring me as I tuck my bare feet out of sight, and he holds out his hand and drips a few spots of red blood onto the sheets. I stare at them as the stain spreads, feeling utterly ashamed, thinking that this is my marriage that starts in my husband's blood with a lie. That'll do, he says. Your mother will come to see this and believe that I've had you. Do you remember what to tell her? That you got on top of me, that it hurt a little, and that I hope we have made a child. I repeat obediently. I am going to keep you as a virgin. Is our secret. He is suddenly serious, almost threatening. Don't forget that. As my wife, you will know my secrets, and this is the first, and one of the greatest of them. The alchemy, the foreseeing, your virginity, these are all secrets that you must keep on your honour. And tell no one. You are of the Royal House of England now, which will bring you greatness, but also great cost. You have to pay the price, as well as enjoy the wealth. I nod, my eyes on his dark face. He rises from the bed and takes his dagger to the bottom sheet. Without thinking of the cost, he slices a thin strip of linen. Mutely he holds it out to me, and I tie it around his wrist over the cut. Pretty maid, he says. I shall see you at breakfast. And then he pulls on his boots and walks from the room. Paris, France, May 1433. We travel with a great entourage, as befits the ruler of France, especially a ruler who holds his lands by force. Ahead of us go an armed guard, a vanguard under the command of the blue-eyed squire, to make sure that the way is safe. Then, after a little gap to let the dust settle, come my Lord Duke and I. I ride behind a burly man at arms, seated pillion, my hands on his belt. My lord rides his war-horse beside me, as if for company, but he barely says one word. I wish I could ride a horse on my own, I remark. He glances at me as if he'd forgotten I was there at all. Not today, he says. It will be hard riding today, and if we meet trouble we might have to go fast. We can't go at a lady's pace, a girl's pace. I say nothing, for it is true, I'm not much of a rider. Then I try again to make a conversation with him. And why is it hard riding today, my lord? For a moment he is silent, as if considering whether he can be troubled to answer me. We're not going to Paris. We're going north to Calais.
Excuse me, but I thought we were going to Paris. Why are we going to Calais, my lord?
He sighs, as if two questions are too much for a man to bear. There was a mutiny at Calais among the garrison. My soldiers, recruited and commanded by me. Bloody fools. I called in on my way to you. Hanged the ringleaders. Now I'm going back to make sure the rest have learned their lesson.
You hanged men on your way to our wedding?
He turned his dark gaze on me. Why not?
I can't really say why not. It just seems to me rather disagreeable. I make a little face and turn away.
He laughs shortly. Better for you that the garrison should be strong, he says. Calais is the rock. All of England's lands in northern France are built on our holding Calais.
We ride on in silence.
He says almost nothing when we stop to eat at midday, except to ask if I'm very tired, and when I say no, he sees that I am fed, and then lifts me back to the pillion saddle for the rest of the ride. The squire comes back and sweeps his hat off to me in a low bow, and then mutters to my lord in a rapid conference, after which we all fall in and ride on. It is twilight as we see the great walls of the castle of Calais looming out of the misty sea plain ahead of us. The land all around is intersected with ditches and canals, divided with little gates, each of them swirling with mist. My lord squire comes riding back when the flag over the top tower of the castle dips in acknowledgement, and the great gates ahead of us swing open. "Soon be home," he says cheerfully to me, as he wheels his horse round.
"Not my home," I observe shortly.
"Oh, it will be," he says. "This is one of your greatest castles."
"In the middle of a mutiny?"
He shakes his head. "That's over now. The garrison hadn't paid for months, and so the soldiers took the wool from the Calais merchants, stole it from their stores. Then the merchants paid to get their goods back. Now my lord, the Duke, will repay them." He grins at my puzzled face. "It's nothing. If the soldiers had been paid on time, it would never have happened."
"Then why did my lord execute someone?"
His smile dims. "So that they remember that next time their wages are late, they have to wait on his pleasure." I glance at my silently listening husband on my other side.
"And what happens now?"
We are approaching the walls. The soldiers are mustering into a guard of honour, running down the steep hill from the castle which sits at the centre of the town, guarding the port to the north and the marshy land to the south. "Now I dismiss the men who stole the goods, dismiss their commander, and appoint a new captain of Calais," my husband says shortly. He looks across at me at the squire. "You?"
"Aye, my lord."
"Yes."
"I'm honoured, but..."
"Are you arguing with me?"
"No, my lord, of course not."
My husband smiles at the silenced young man.
"That's good."
To me, he says, "This young man, my squire, my friend, Richard Woodville, has fought in almost every campaign here in France and was knighted on the battlefield by the late king, my brother. His father served us too. He's not yet 30 years old, but I know of no one more loyal or trustworthy. He can command this garrison, and while he's here I can be sure that there will be no mutinies, and no complaints, and no thieving. And there will be no arguing about my orders. Is that right, Woodville?"
"Quite right, sir," he says.
And then the three of us go through the dark, echoing doorway and up the cobbled streets, past the hanged mutineers swinging silently on the gallows, through the bowing citizens, to the castle of Calais. "Am I to stay here now?" Woodville asks, as if it is a mere matter of a bed for the night.
"Not yet," my husband says. "I have need of you by me."
We stay only 3 nights, long enough for my husband,
to dismiss half of the soldiers of the garrison and send to England for their replacements. Long enough to warn their commander that he will be replaced by the squire, Sir Richard Woodville. And then we rattle down the cobbled street and out of the gateway and go south down the road to Paris. The squire, Woodville, at the head of the troop once more. Me on the lumbering horse of the man-at-arms, and my husband in grim silence. It is a 2-day ride before we see the Grange Batelier standing over the desolate countryside outside the city. Beyond it are worked fields and little dairy farms that gradually give way to small market gardens that surround the city walls. We enter through the northwest gate, close to the Louvre, and I see at once my Paris home, the Hôtel de Bourbon, one of the greatest houses in the city, as befits the ruler of France. It stands beside the King's Palace of the Louvre, looking south over the river, like a building in March pane, all turrets and roofs and towers and balconies. I should have known that it would be a great house, having seen my lord's castle at Rouen. But when we ride up to the great gates, I feel like a princess in a story being taken into a giant's fortress. A fortified wall runs all around, and there is a guardhouse at every gate, which reminds me, if I were in any danger of forgetting, that my husband may be the ruler, but not everyone recognizes him as the representative of the God-given king. The one whom many prefer to call the King of France is not far away, at Chinon, eyeing our lands and stirring up trouble. The one whom we call the King of France and England is safe in London, too poor to send my husband the money and troops he needs to keep these faithless lands in subjection, too weak to command his lords to come to fight under our standard. My lord gives me several days of freedom to find my way around my new home, to discover the former duchess's jewel box, and her dressing room of furs and fine gowns. And then he comes to my room after matins, and says, "Come, Jacquetta, I have work for you today." I follow him, trotting like a puppy at his heels, as he leads me through the gallery where tapestries of gods look down on us, to a double door at the end, two men-at-arms on either side, and his squire, Woodville, lounging on the window-sill. He jumps up when he sees us, and gives me a low bow. The men-at-arms swing open the doors, and we go inside. I don't know what I'm expecting, certainly not this. First, there is a room as big as a great hall, but looking like a library in a monastery. There are shelves of dark wood, and on them are scrolls and books, locked away behind brass grills. There are tall tables and high stools so that you can sit up at a desk and unfurl a scroll and read it at your leisure. There are tables made ready for study with pots of ink and sharpened quills and pages of paper ready for taking notes. I have never seen anything like it outside of an abbey, and I look up at my husband with new respect. He has spent a fortune here. Each one of these books will have cost as much as the Duchess's jewels.
"I have the finest collection of books and manuscripts outside the church in Europe," he says, "and my own copyists."
He gestures to two young men either side of a stand, one of whom is intoning strange words, reading from a scroll, while the other, painstakingly, writes.
"Translating from the Arabic," my husband says. "Arabic to Latin, and from there to French or English. The Moors are the source of great knowledge, of all mathematics, all science. I buy the scrolls, and I have them translated myself. This is how I've put us ahead in the search for knowledge, because I've tapped the source."
He smiles, suddenly pleased with me.
"Just as I have with you. I have gone to the very source of the mysteries."
In the center of the room is a great table, painted and sculpted. I exclaim in delight and step closer to examine it. It's enchanting, like a little country, if one could view it from above, flying high over it like an eagle. It is the country of France. I can see the outer wall of the city of Paris, and the Seine flowing through, painted bright blue. I can see the Île de Paris, a little maze of buildings shaped like a boat itself, set in the river. Then I can see how the land is divided. The top half of France is painted white and red in the colours of England, and the bottom half is left blank. And an Armagnac flag shows Charles, the pretend king, in his lands at Chinon. A series of scratches show where the little flags were stabbed, furiously, rapidly, in the plan marking the triumphant march of Joan of Arc halfway across France, victorious all the way, and then up to the very walls of Paris only 2 years ago. "The whole of France is ours by right," my husband says, looking jealously at the green lands that lead down to the Mediterranean Sea. "And we will have it. We will have it. I shall win it for God and King Harry." "Look, we are advancing," he says, showing me the little flags of St. George for England, spreading over the east of France. "And if the Duke of Burgundy will remain true and a good ally, we can win back our lands in Maine. If the Dauphin is fool enough to attack the Duke, and I think that he is, and if I can persuade the Duke that we both fight at once..." He breaks off as he sees I'm looking upwards. "Oh, those are my planets," he says, as if he owns the night skies quite as much as he does France. Suspended from criss-crossing wooden beams is a series of beautiful silver spheres, some of them ringed with silver halos, some with other tiny balls floating nearby. It's such a pretty sight that I forget all about the map and the flags of campaigns and clasp my hands together. "Oh, how pretty! What is this?" Woodville, the squire, gives a little choke of laughter. "It's not for amusement," my husband says dourly. Then he nods at one of the clerks. "Oh, well, show the Duchess the skies at her birth." The young man steps forward. "Excuse me, Your Grace, when were you born?" I flush. Like almost all girls, I don't know the date of my birth. My parents didn't trouble to record the day and the time. I only know the year and the season. And I only know the season because my mother had a great desire for asparagus when she was carrying me, and swears that she ate it too green, and her bellyache brought on my birth. "Spring, 1416, I say. "Perhaps May?" He pulls out a scroll from the library and spreads it across the tall desk. He looks at it carefully, then reaches out and pulls one of the levers, then another. To my absolute delight, the balls with their halos and the little balls spinning descend from the rafters and move gently around until they are positioned, swaying slightly, in the places in heaven that they held at the moment of my birth. There is a sweet tinkling noise, and I see that the spheres have tiny silver bells attached to the strings that move them, so they play as they take their places. "I can predict where the planets will be before I start a battle," my husband says. "I only launch a campaign when they tell me the stars are propitious. But it takes hours to calculate on paper, and it's easy to make a mistake. Here, we've built a mechanism as beautiful and as regular as God made when he put the stars in the sky and set them in motion. I have made a machine like the workings of God himself."
"Can you foretell with them? Can you know what will happen?"
He shakes his head. "Not as I hope that you will do for us. I can tell when the time is ripe, but not the nature of the fruit. I can tell that our star is in the ascendant, but not the outcome of a particular battle. And we had no warning at all of the Witch of Arc."
The clerk tilts his head sadly.
Satan hid her from us, he says simply. There was no darkness, there was no comet. There was nothing to show her rising, and nothing marked her death. Praise to God.
My husband nods, and puts his hand under my arm, and leads me away from the table, and past the clerk.
My brother was a man of Mars, he says. Heat and fire, heat and dryness. A man born to fight and win battles. His son is wet and cold. A man young in years, but like a child in his heart. Damp like a wet baby drinking milk and pissing in his clout. I have to wait for the stars to put some fire into his cause. I have to study for weapons to put into his hand. He is my nephew, and I must guide him. I am his uncle, and he is my king. I have to make him victorious. It is my duty. It is my destiny. You will help me in this, too.
Woodville waits for a moment. Then, as my lord seems to have fallen into deep thought, he opens the door to the next room, pushes it wide, and stands back so we can go through. I step into the stone-floored room, and my nose prickles at the strange scents. There's a tang like the smell of a forge, hot metal, but also something acidic and sharp. The air is acrid with a smoke that stings my eyes. In the centre of the room are four men, dressed in leather aprons, charcoal fires glowing before them in little braziers set into stone benches, vessels of bronze bubbling like saucepots. Beyond them, through the open door that leads to an inner yard, I can see a lad stripped to the waist, working the bellows of a furnace, heating a great chamber like a bread oven. I look across at Woodville. He gives me a reassuring nod as if to say, "Don't be afraid." But the smell of the room is sulphurous, and the furnace outside glows like the entrance to hell. I shrink back, and my husband laughs at my pale face.
"Nothing to fear. I told you there would be nothing to fear. This is where they work on the recipes. This is where they try one elixir and then another. Out there, we forge the metals and bring them in to be tested. This is where we're going to make silver, gold, to make life itself."
"It's so hot," I say weakly.
"These are the fires that make water turn to wine," he explains, "that make iron turn to gold, that make earth turn to life. Everything in this world is growing to a state of purity, of perfection. This is where we speed it up. This is where we make the changes to metals and to waters that the world itself does in its deep bowels over centuries. With heat like hatching an egg into a chicken. We make it hotter. We make it faster. This is where we can test what we know and see what we learn. This is the heart of my life's work."
Outside in the yard, someone pulls a red-hot bar of metal from the coals of the furnace and starts to hammer it flat.
"Just think, if I could make gold," he says longingly. "If I could take iron and purify it so that the common traces were burned from it, washed away, so that we had gold coin. I could hire soldiers. I could reinforce defences. I could feed Paris. If I had my own mint and my own gold mine, I could take all of France for my nephew and keep it forever."
"Is it possible?"
"We know it can be done," he says. "Indeed, it has been done many, many times, though always in secret. All metal is of the same nature. Everything is made of the same thing. First matter, they call it in the books. Dark matter. This is the stuff that the world is made of. We have to remake it. Make it again. So we take dark matter
and we refine it, and refine it again. We make it transform into its purest and best nature.
He pauses, looking at my puzzled face.
You know that they make wine with the juice that comes from grapes.
I nod.
Any French peasant can do that. First he takes the grapes, then he crushes them for their juice. He takes a fruit, a solid thing growing on a vine, and makes it into a liquid. That's alchemy itself, making that change. Then he stores it, and lets the life within it change that juice into wine. Another liquid, but one with quite different properties from the juice. Now I can go further. I have done another change right here. I can make an essence from wine that is 100 times stronger than wine, which burns at the sight of a flame, which cures a man of melancholy and watery humours. It is a liquid, but it is hot and dry. We call it aqua vitae, the water of life. All this I can do already. I can change juice to aqua vitae. The gold is just the next step. Gold from iron.
And what am I to do? I ask nervously.
Nothing today, he says. But perhaps tomorrow, or the next day, they will need you to come and pour some liquid from a flask, or stir a bowl, or sieve some dust. Nothing more than that. You could have done as much in your mother's dairy.
I look at him blankly.
It is your touch I want, he says. The pure touch.
One of the men, who has been watching a flask bubble and then overflow through a tube into a cool dish set in a bath of ice, puts it to one side and comes towards us, wiping his hand on his apron and bowing to my husband.
The maid, my husband says, gesturing to me, as if I am as much an object as the fluid in the flask or the iron in the furnace. I flinch at being given Joan's name. As I promised, I have her. Melusina's daughter, and a virgin untouched by any man.
I put my hand out in greeting, but the man recoils from me. He laughs at himself and says, smiling to my husband,
I hardly dare to touch her. Indeed, I dare not.
Instead, he puts his hand behind his back and bows very low and says directly to me,
You are welcome, Lady Bedford. Your presence here has been needed for a long time. We have waited for you. We have hoped that you would come. You will bring a harmony with you. You will bring the power of the moon and water with you. And your touch will make all things pure.
I step awkwardly from one foot to the other and glance at my husband. He's looking at me with a sort of hot approbation.
I found her, and I recognized at once what she could be, he says. What she could do. I knew that she could be Luna for us. She has water in her veins, and her heart is pure. Who knows what she might not be able to do? Can she scry? The man asks eagerly. She says she's never tried. But she has already foreseen the future, my husband replies. Shall we try her?
In the library.
The man leads the way back through the door. My husband snaps his fingers, and the two scholars take themselves off into a side room, as the alchemist and Woodville the squire pull a cloth off the biggest looking-glass I have ever seen, framed in a case, completely round, shining silver, like a full moon.
Close the shutters, my husband says, and light the candles.
He is breathless. I can hear the excitement in his voice, and it makes me fearful. They ring me with candles so that I am encircled in fire. and they put me before the big mirror. It is so bright I can hardly see for the winking, bobbing flames around me.
You ask her, my husband says to the alchemist. Before God, I am so excited I can't speak. But don't tax her overmuch. Let's just see if she has a gift.
Look in the mirror. The man commands me quietly. Let yourself look in the mirror. And let yourself dream. Now, Nade, what can you see?
I look in the mirror. Surely it's obvious what I can see. Myself, in a velvet gown cut in the very latest fashion, with a horned headdress on my head, my golden hair captured in a thick net on each side of my face, and the most wonderful shoes of blue leather. I've never before seen a mirror that could show me myself, all of me, full size. I lift my gown a little, so that I can admire my shoes. And the alchemist makes a little dry cough, as if to remind me to beware vanity.
What can you see when you look deeply, Duchess?
Behind me, and to the side of me, is a dazzle of candles so bright that they drain the colour from the gown, even from the blue shoes, even from the shelves and the books behind me, that as I look, grow darker and more misty.
Look deep into the mirror, and say what you can see.
The man urges again, his voice low.
Tell us what you can see, Lady Bedford. What can you see?
The light is overwhelming, too bright to see anything. I cannot even see my own face, dazzled by the hundreds of candles. And then I see her, as clearly as the day when we lazed by the moat, as brightly as when she was alive and laughing, before the moment when she drew the card of Le Pendu, in his suit as blue as my shoes.
Joan, I say quietly with deep sorrow. Oh, Joan the maid.
I struggle to come back to wakefulness through the noise of the alchemist flapping at the candles to put them out. Some must have fallen over when I went down in a faint. Woodville the squire has me in his arms, holding up my head, and my husband is sprinkling cold water in my face.
What did you see? My lord demands, as soon as my eyelids flutter open.
I don't know.
For some reason, a sudden pang of fear warns me. I don't want to tell him. I don't want to say Joan's name to the man who had her burned alive.
What did she say?
He glares at the squire and at the alchemist.
As she went down, she said something, I heard something. What did she say?
Did she say, the maid?
The alchemist asks.
I think she did.
They both look at Woodville.
She said, it's maid.
He lies easily.
What could she mean? The Duke looks at me. What did you mean? What do you mean, Jaquetta? Would it be your Grace's university at Calm? Woodville asks. I think she said, Calm. And then she said, it's maid.
I saw your Grace's planned university at Calm, I say, taking up the prompt. Completed. Beautiful. That's what I said. It's maid.
He smiles. He is pleased. Well, that's a good vision, he says, encouraged. That's a good glimpse of a safe and happy future. That's good news. And best of all, we see she can do it.
He puts out his arm and helps me to my feet.
So, he says with a triumphant smile to the alchemist, I will bring her back tomorrow after Mass, after she's broken her fast. Get a chair for her to sit on next time, and make the room ready for her. We will see what she can tell us. But she can do it, can't she?
Without a doubt, agrees the alchemist. and I will have everything ready." He bows and goes back into the inner room, and Woodville picks up the rest of the candles and blows them out, and my lord straightens the mirror. I lean for a moment against an archway between one set of shelves and another, and my husband glances up and sees me.
"Stand there."
He gestures me to the centre of the arch, and watches as I obey him. I stand still, framed in the arch, wondering what he wants now. He's staring at me, as if I were a picture or a tapestry myself, as if he sees me as an object, a new thing to be framed or translated or shelved. He narrows his eyes as if considering me as a vista or a statue that he might have bought.
"I'm so glad that I married you," he says,
and there is no affection in his voice at all, but the satisfied tone of a man who has added something to his beautiful collection, and that at a good price.
"Whatever it costs me, with Burgundy, with whoever, I'm so glad that I married you. You are my treasure."
I glance nervously at Richard Woodville, who has heard this speech of acquisition, but he is busy throwing the cloth over the looking glass, and quite deaf. Every morning, my lord escorts me to the library, and they seat me before the mirror and light the candles all around me, and ask me to look into the brightness and tell them what I see. I find I go into a sort of daze, not quite asleep, but almost dreaming. And sometimes I see extraordinary visions on the swimming silver surface of the mirror. I see a baby in a cradle. I see a ring shaped like a golden crown dangling from a dripping thread. And one morning I turn from the mirror crying out, for I see a battle, and behind it, another battle. A long lane of battles, and men dying, dying in mist, dying in snow, dying in a churchyard.
"Did you see the standards?"
my husband demands as they press a glass of small ale into my hand.
"Drink. Did you see the standards? You said nothing clearly. Did you see where the battles were taking place? Could you tell the armies one from another?"
I shake my head.
"Could you see what town? Was it anywhere you recognize? Come and see if you can point out the town on the map. Do you think it is happening right now? Or is it a vision from the future that will come?"
He drags me to the table where the little world of France is laid before me, and I look dazed at the patchwork of ownership and roll of the hills. "I don't know," I say. "There was a mist and an army forcing their way uphill. There was snow, and it was red with blood. There was a queen with her horse at a forge, and they were putting the horseshoes on backwards." He looks at me as if he would like to shake some sense out of me.
"This is no good to me, girl," he says, his voice very low. "I can get cursed in any Saturday market. I need to know what is going to happen this year. I need to know what's going to happen in France. I need names of towns and the numbers of rebels. I need to know in detail."
Dumbly, I look back at him. His face is suffused with darkness in his frustration with me.
"I'm saving a kingdom here," he says. "I need more than mist and snow. I didn't marry you for you to tell me about queens with their horseshoes on back to front. What next? Mermaids in the bath?"
I shake my head. Truly, I know nothing.
"Jacquetta, I swear, you will be sorry if you defy me,"
he says with quiet menace.
"This is too important for you to play the fool."
"Perhaps we should not overtax her," Woodville suggests, addressing the bookshelves.
"Perhaps every day is too much for her. She's only young and new to the work. Perhaps we should train her up to it.
like a little falcon.